You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today, this being Friday, with my good friend, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Now, did I hear wrongly that it's actually not Reverend Mister, that there was some correction in the nomenclature, or is it still Reverend Mister?
Reverend Mister is the style, not the form of address, but the style for deacons who are transitional deacons, who are on the path to the priesthood. Deacons like myself, who are permanent deacons according to the official document that governs such things. And this is the Catholic Church. You know there is one.
There is one.
There is one.
It is. It's so true.
We are simply deacon.
You're
we are deacon as a style, and we are deacon as a form of address. So if you walk up to me, it's, hey, deacon. And if you look at the bulletin, it should say Deacon Stephen Gradonis. It should not say Reverend Mister, unless I am on the path to the priesthood, which, considering that I have a wife who I love and seven children, I'm thinking I'm not currently on that
path. Not currently on that glide path. Okay, well, you know, that's super important. And of course, there's a special dispensation for people who live within New Jersey or the five boroughs of New York. You are allowed to call all deacons Deke.
Deke, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
That's just how it goes.
That actually comes from the Vatican. There was a dispensation under Pius XII.
Yes.
Now, in the 1950s. Not a lot of people know that.
That is a true thing that you just said. And I believe you. So we're here today. I have been, of course, as many people know, I am a deeply spiritual person, and I have been locked in spiritual combat on your behalf.
Because
I have the Tiber. Announced today that Pope Francis says it is better to be an atheist than to enjoy the DC cinematic universe.
Ah!
So I was moved.
So wait, why were you praying for me?
Well, to you know, move you from your passionate love of the DC universe, and it worked. You announced today that you much prefer the Marvel universe, which, as I remember things, that's a major change. So I'm. I believe that my intercessory prayer.
Is this one of those things like frequency, where we're talking from two different universes or something?
All I know is that my intercessory prayer went back and changed the past so that.
Okay, so it is like frequency, but with prayer.
Yes, exactly.
Well, now we have to ask all of our listeners now to pray for Mark, because of course. Although this was not reported in Eye of the Tiber, I happen to know from my channels, being a well-informed Catholic gentleman of the clergy as I am, that there was a follow-up question from a reporter who asked about those who hate Marvel movies, and the Pope's off-the-cuff response was, we must always be merciful, but there are limits.
All right. Well, you know, that's... enough of this theological banter. You know, I think when we come down to it, what we're really saying is I'm right and you're wrong. So we'll just move along from there.
Sounds like an excellent idea. Where you have
we've got movies to talk about. It sounds like they've basically kind of done a medieval version of World War Z. Maybe it's, what is it, World War C? I don't know.
Oh, are we talking about the Great Wall?
The Great Wall.
The Great Wall. Yes.
I read your review of the Great Wall in the Register today, and it sounds like just kind of medieval Pacific Rim or something, or medieval Chinese World War Z. But
well, one thing that I have to say about Zhang Yimou, the director of this film and of many other excellent films, including one of my top films from last year, Coming Home, just an amazing portrayal of marital love and sacrifice. One thing that I have to say about Zhang Yimou is that whether his films are good or bad or somewhere in between, and he has made movies all over that spectrum, they are always worth looking at. I have more than once come out of a Zhang Yimou film actively angry at him over how it ended, but I have never walked out of a Zhang Yimou film feeling bored and let down by what I saw. And that's even true of The Great Wall to a certain extent.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, talk more about it, man. I mean, we're talking about Matt Damon, perhaps America's greatest living actor.
actually, you know, if I think I would have liked this film better if there were no Matt Damon and if it were shot entirely in Chinese, and instead of going to Weta for these kind of vaguely cat-like monsters that we have in this film, if it had been, you know, the more traditional Asian movie kind of monsters, you could have guys in rubber outfits for all I care. The parts of the movie that were familiar to me were the parts that bored me, and the parts that were unfamiliar were the parts that I liked. Now, maybe that's because I'm a bored film critic, and Suzanne will tell you all about. She has a theory that there's a condition called bored critic syndrome.
Okay.
And what bored critic syndrome means is critics are exposed to so many movies that are so monotonously like every other movie that they've seen that whenever a movie does anything different, they sit up in their chair and they go, "Ooh, shiny."
Okay.
It doesn't have to be good, different, or bad, different. Different is good if you have bored critic syndrome, according to Suzanne.
Okay.
So The Great Wall did show me things I have never seen before. And that is a phrase, you will find that phrase in my reviews from time to time. Anything that can show me something, a movie that can show me something that I have never seen before, that in itself does give me point. Now, if it's something ugly and horrifying and something that I never want to see again, you know, that's going to take away some points. But
right.
But on the whole, you know, you don't go to the movies. At least I don't go to the movies. You know, I would say everyone except for, you know, mainstream American audiences, people don't want to just have the same experience over and over and over again, at least once they've kind of woken up and started to think, you know.
Right.
Obviously, on a certain level, there are a lot of people who want to go to McDonald's and eat the exact same Happy Meal that they ate last time, and they want it to be the same in every respect except for the secret toy surprise inside. It's the only thing that changes. And this is what the Lego movie was all about. You know, what's your favorite restaurant? Any chain restaurant. What's your favorite song? Everything is awesome. What's your favorite TV show? Where are my pants?
Yeah, it's true. And you know, and that's part of the function of a trailer these days, is to ensure the audience that you know exactly what you're going to get before you go see it.
Yes.
I remember years ago watching when Jurassic Park came out, we went into the theater and they showed a trailer for Free Willy.
Right, right.
And it was, I mean, the trailer.
Literally the whole plot.
It was the whole movie.
Right.
It was like, why am I going to go see this movie now? I know everything that happens, including the climax.
Yes.
What's the point, you know?
Well, so in The Great Wall, Matt Damon plays a European mercenary who goes to China sometime about 1,000 years ago, I guess. This is in the European Middle Ages. And they've heard that in China they have this substance, this mysterious black powder, which has the property of turning air into fire. And so when they get there, what they find is this amazing wall with these rows and rows of soldiers who have like acrobatic martial arts skills on the level of like Legolas from Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've got all their color-coded uniforms, and they've got these like bungee jumping samurai suicide girls who walk out on these platforms off the edge of the wall. And these platforms, it like splits out into these four or five beams, and they walk out on the edge of the beam like the most daring prisoner in the world, walking off of the narrowest, scariest plank on a pirate ship with this cord tied to them, and with a spear, they dive off, and they're doing pirouettes and spinning as they go down into what turns out to be the slavering pool of monsters that assail the wall. And the idea is you stab the monster with your spear, and hopefully all of the girls back up on the wall pull you back up before the monsters bite you in half. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't work.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's something I've never seen before. And it's really cool to look at because it's got, you know, in addition to the balletic grace of these acrobatic girls on the cords, it's got ideas of, you know, dedication and trust and commitment to a cause and willingness to sacrifice. You know, you're leaping off this platform and you trust your friends back up on the wall. They're going to pull you up, and you're doing it for something greater than yourself.
Well, you know, we will continue this discussion. a number of questions immediately come to mind. But we will continue this discussion with Deacon Stephen Gardonis talking about the new film, The Great Wall. Here on Connecting the Dots, right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to the host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. We've been talking about The Great Wall, new film with Matt Damon that's just come out. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And something I wanted to ask you about, just because it's a pretty common theme. It's especially a common theme in American filmmaking. But it's one that you really can trace back quite a long way, which is the concept of the white savior. So Dances with Wolves. It's the awesome white guy who walks into the middle of the exotic other culture and discovers that they're awesome, but then becomes the most awesome member of that culture himself.
Yes.
And shows them all, you know, how to really do it. So it's something that comes up again and again. It's a story that in some ways you can find even traceable, I would argue, back to the book of Exodus, where you have Moses, who's raised by Pharaoh, after all. Yes, he's a Hebrew by blood, but is raised by Pharaoh. But then at some point has his consciousness raised and happens on the, the Egyptian that's hurting a Hebrew. So he kills the Egyptian. And then the next day he kind of steps into some argument between two Hebrew slaves and, you know, tries to break it up. And they say, so are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? And so the whole sort of, child of privilege who suddenly identifies with the underdog story
is
there.
Very interesting. What what makes it's, I think it's worth noting that this raises a very interesting question, because there are terms that are used as terms of criticism that can also be used as descriptive neutral terms. Take deus ex machina. Deus ex machina is a term that we were all taught back in school. A plot or a story is bad when it uses deus ex machina. And what we imagine is a story where the writer has written himself into a corner, and then they bring in magic, they bring in the gods. The god is literally lowered down from the heavens by a stage machine in the ancient Greek theater, hence the term. And this is bad drama, because the story should not be solved by magic from heaven. And yet, if you think about it, there's nothing wrong with a story that's solved by magic. It's just when the magic comes in arbitrarily. That's the problem is an arbitrary ending that doesn't flow from the conditions. So a magical ending that flows from the story drama to date is perfectly fine. Whereas I think C.S. Lewis points out, a hero who gets into financial problems and then everything is solved by an inheritance from a previously unmentioned uncle in the drama who has now died, that's just as much deus ex machina.
Right.
From the perspective of the plot badness of it. So with a term like white savior, if we use that to mean a person from privilege who plays a redemptive role in the lives of a civilization of a lower level of development, or somehow disadvantaged or whatever, the difference between that term as a term of criticism and the story of Exodus is that the story of the Exodus is it's the Hebrews telling their own story, story of how they were saved by one of their own who was elevated in Pharaoh's court and then came back to them. Whereas when we as white people, when white Hollywood makes white savior stories for white audiences to watch, it's one of our guys. It could be Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai, or Sam Worthington in Avatar going to live with the blue people on Pandora. Then it's one of our guys who goes and lives among the exotic other, and he becomes the best of them. And of course, the implication is that we're all superior to them.
Right.
There was a lot of fear that the Great Wall would embody this kind of archetype. Matt Damon is the awesome archer who goes to China and he shows the Chinese how it's really done. Mm-hmm. And it is true that Damon has Legolas level mad archery skills. If you watch the trailer, you can see this trick that he does with his friend where the guy throws a bowl up in the air and he shoots a trio of arrows, and he's got the bowl perched on two arrows pinned up against a pillar. So yes, he's a great archer, but really when he gets to China, what he discovers is that these people are way beyond his level. In terms of their military discipline, their skill, the thing that they're up against. And he does join forces with them, not to lead them, not to give them the benefit of his awesome skills, which are so much better than theirs. But really, they inspire him to rise to a higher level of heroism and sacrifice and commitment. They show him something that's lacking in his culture. And if you think about it, this is also an aspect of many white savior movies. This is the side which is it's sort of subversive in the other direction. The reason why Kevin Costner becomes Dances with Wolves is because he's already a cultural orphan, because white European mainstream culture is bankrupt. See, we're all orphans of a bankrupt culture, as I think in Die Hard, I think Hans Gruber says something about that. And so what on the one hand, these movies are patronizing to the exotic culture, but on the other hand, they're also subversively hostile to our own culture, because the people on the other side of the line, they have a home. They have a culture that deserves their commitment and that tells them who they are and it gives them values and it gives them something to sacrifice for, gives them trust and commitment and all these other things. And Western European culture never seems to do that for the white hero.
Right. Well, and that, you know, it's in a funny way, it's a kind of act of pride. You know, the sin of despair is rooted in pride, and the way it works is instead of saying I'm so awesome that I don't need God to save me, you wind up saying things I'm so uniquely bad that, you know, nobody is as bad as I am. I am the worst of all time. And it's a kind of a boast. And that curiously can play out in that narrative as well, that the evil Western civilization, there's nothing as bad.
And, so in a weirdly counterintuitive way, Western cultural self-loathing is a form of Eurocentrism.
Absolutely it is. And a story like that remains deeply Eurocentric. And it's a very weird thing, but it's true.
There is something to that, seriously. And I want to point out another example. The history of Western, the history of spiritual cinema is full of heroes who are spiritually questing, who have not found God, who are searching for the meaning of life. And this goes from everything from Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal to Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven. And one thing that I've noticed about these films is that the hero's quest is almost always in cultural and social isolation. You know, the knight in The Seventh Seal never goes to mass. He never engages in any corporate worship. He doesn't try to join any community. He doesn't try to find his way within the context of a religion as an actual cultural institution.
In other words, he's a mid-20th century Swede.
Exactly. And this is very striking when you look at Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven, because the Europeans who are those who are, you know, spiritually searching, like Balian, the protagonist of the film, they're loners, they're isolated, they're cut off from corporate worship. But in the Middle East, they see Muslims. And Muslims have a religious and cultural identity. They have a connection with God because they get together and they bow down and they pray five times a day. And it's they have this religious fabric. Whereas why doesn't Balian go to mass? Where is the religious cultural institution and community in these films for Westerners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something that drives me crazy about late 20th century, early 21st century cinema in general, is that it really, you know, for all of its commitment to, you know, diversity and multiculturalism and so on and so forth, there's nothing more resolutely provincial than a huge movie coming out of Hollywood. You know, the idea that a medieval Westerner might look to his own culture, it's just not there.
And so what you have here is a combination of the Chinese government sponsoring this film, and of course their rah-rah patriotic, you know, pro-China, combined with Hollywood Western cynicism. It's a perfect marriage.
It's self-loathing. Well, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis. We're talking about The Great Wall, and we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
host Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking about life at the movies. If you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And we're moving on now from talking about the Great Wall and talking about another really important subject, which is the best films of 2016, according to people who are not Deacon Stephen Gradonis.
Yes. Yes, this is a very important topic, and it's appropriate that we discuss this as we're ramping up to the Academy Awards this weekend.
Okay.
Which there seems to be a strange curse of us talking on this show about the Academy Awards. In my mind, every time I start to talk about the Academy Awards, like the music starts swelling,
and we're all out of time. The show is over.
I think I'm going to have to remember that for the future. If I ever like just have a complete brain freeze and I can't think of anything to talk about, I'm just going to say, speaking of the 2017 Academy Awards, and the music will come in.
Just make it happen. It's like a miracle. Yeah.
It's kind of like the Oscar recipients who go on and on with their talks too long. You know, the music comes up in the background and, you know, they're ushered off stage.
Yep. Well, so talk about it. Talk about
Well, so every year for the past, I think, 7 years now, if I'm not mistaken, maybe it's six or it's either 6 or 7 years, sometime after doing my top 10 list, I have circled back and surveyed a slowly growing number of my friends and peers, a circle of people who have some kind of connection with one another in the world of Christian cinephiles. And
okay.
Many of these individuals are card-carrying film critics who write for the religious film critics who write for the religious press. Mm-hmm. Some of us are just members of that social circle who have blogs and who follow the discussion and who write within that milieu. And it's, you know, it started out being me and Jeff Overstreet and a few other people, and it's gradually expanded to include many more. And this year I added the well-known Protestant writer Josh Larson of Film Spotting. This is the first time that I've included him in my roundup. And I've got a blog post. It's up at decentfilms.com, and it links over to the National Catholic Register, like everything I do for the first 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And when I after I do this, after I post all the different top 10 lists. So I always list only the top 10, even though I also say sometimes it'll be, you know, if you go to the person's website, they might have a top 20 or a top 25 or a top 30 or a top 40 or whatever it is.
Okay.
I only list the top 10 at my, and then I kind of sit back and I do the math and I say, which movies did we agree on? Which movies did we disagree on? What got the consensus? What didn't? And this year, something really remarkable happened. Now, you may have gotten tired of hearing me talk on this show about my top three films of 2016, which, of course, is I'm sure everyone listening knows my number one film. It was Patterson. My number two film was the documentary Camera Person. And my number three film was Martin Scorsese's Silence. Well, never let it be said that my friends and I, that we all have, you know, We have bubble thinking, and we're all on the same wavelength, because let me tell you, of the 11 lists that I surveyed, Silence was the number one, not the number three. And Camera Person was number two, and Patterson was not number one, but number three. So my top three films were straight reversed. How's that for a twist?
I scarce can take it in. But you all basically had the same top three films.
Pretty much, you know. Actually, there were only two of us that picked those exact three films as our top three films, me and Jeff. But Camera Person did wind up being picked as number one or number two more often than anything else. And I
totally missed Camera. I don't think we've discussed Camera Person on this show.
Have we not?
No, I've never heard of it.
So, well, I know that I've at least mentioned it, and we've probably have blown past it somewhat, but I'm certainly happy to talk about it. It is cinephile catnip. It's a movie that the more you watch movies, and especially the more you watch documentaries, the more interesting and potentially powerful you're likely to find it. It's by a documentary cinematographer whose name is Kirsten Johnson. And she has worked on a lot of documentaries over the last, I don't know how long her career actually has been, but she worked on a documentary called Pray the Devil Back to Hell by, Jeannie Rediker. She worked on a documentary on Jacques Derrida. She's done a lot.
Okay.
And Darfur Now, that was another big one that she did. And what she's done here in Camera Person is she's gone back through all of her footage that she shot while making these documentaries and culled footage that wasn't used in those films and kind of stitched it together into what you could call a scrapbook or a memoir of a career as a cinematographer. And at first, the clips seem kind of random, and some of them are interesting. Some of them, they require certain patience. But as you watch, some themes begin to come together. Moral themes about the lives of the people that she's capturing, certain covert interactions between herself as a filmmaker and the people in their lives. Sometimes there is an element of drama or danger in the situation. And, you know, as the viewer feel like you want to step into the story and intervene. And what is it like to be behind the camera at that moment?
Okay.
And what the film becomes eventually is what I've called a kind of cumulative examination of conscience, and even at times a kind of a confession regarding the filmmaker's relationship to her subjects and her responsibility to her subjects. When is it morally wrong to put something that you were privileged to film and maybe shouldn't have filmed, and certainly, you know, that you shouldn't share this with the world?
Mm-hmm.
When does it become questionable to continue to remain objective behind the camera? When should you maybe put the camera down? And you know, these are the kinds of questions that Camera Person raises. And as someone who watches a lot of movies and not as many documentaries as I'd like, I found this absolutely fascinating.
Okay, interesting. This is plus, you know, a tonic for the bored critic syndrome.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's something that you'd never see.
That's right.
So, and that's so important. We don't want our critics to get bored. You know,
no.
If that happens, the unthinkable could take place. I can't even think of what that would be. Okay.
It would probably take the form of some really scathing nonfiction prose, let me tell you.
I am very, very put out. Yes.
So these three films, Silence, Camera Person, and Patterson, my number one, they are... I and all of the people that I hang around with, we all agree.
Yes. Okay. Well then.
I will mention, and this is a movie that you can see right now on Amazon, and I've talked about it before, but this was the fourth most honored film, Hell or High Water. I just recommended it to my mother, who watched it with her sister and brother-in-law and her own husband. And these are somewhat different people who have different movie tastes. They all loved it. I loved it. Suzanne loved it. Hell or High Water. This is a really, really good modern day neo-Western road movie, crime drama. Very, very interesting, extremely well-written film.
Okay. That's what I've heard. I've heard over and over again that the script is just impeccable. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Okay, keep going. Number five.
After those films, there are a few that A few of the films made four lists. There was Love and Friendship, which we've talked about. This is Whit Stillman does Jane Austen. Was Moonlight, which I think we've talked about. This is the growing up black and gay in Miami movie. And it's based on a stage play. It's set in three different periods in the life of its protagonist, first as a young boy and then as an adolescent and then as a grown up. And it can be hard to watch for you as a Catholic because of the sexuality themes. But it's a film that has some very interesting things to say about masculinity and how about the heartlessness of the world to not necessarily to a boy who is actually gay, but just to a boy who's soft and different, and how contempt for gays and fear of stigma kind of imposes this rough image of masculinity on young men who either, either you have to suffer the consequences or you have to keep on others.
All right. Well, we are up against the break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Radonis, and we'll be back on Connecting the Dots after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Radonis. We have been talking about life at the movies. This is slightly off topic, but I just want to put in a plug for the Neil Patrick Harris series based on a series of unfortunate events, which is just fantastic.
I watched the first episode of that, and I really enjoyed it. I was hoping it would be something that we could watch together as a family, because I'm always on the lookout for shows like that, and there aren't many. And I have to say that although I enjoyed it, and I think Suzanne enjoyed it, it was, in spite of the leavening humor, it was a little too dark for most of the kids, and Yeah.
Kids are older,
Right. Well, I have some older kids too, but even my older kids are really serious. Except for the one who's at college. He's not serious at all. He probably really like it, but he wasn't with us. So okay. I'm looking for stuff that I can watch with most of the others. But I did like it, and Patrick Warburton, always very funny.
Yes.
Not sure that he will ever do anything that I will love as much as Kronk.
It's not possible for him to do anything that you can love as much as Kronk. That is the apex of his career, and there's just no way around that. But still, the guy is he's one of these guys that could just read from the phone book, and he will still make me laugh. And I got to say, the script by Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, is just first rate. It's just super great. So anyway, highly, highly recommended. So what else were we going to talk? We talked about, what'd you want to talk about next? There was something.
There've been a couple of funny, since we're at the tail end of the show here. Why don't we just banter a little? Some silly things that have been going around on Facebook that I thought were really funny. And one of them had to do, with the new motto of the Washington Post, which listeners may not have heard of.
Yes. The new Washington Post, I'm not making this up, you know, so newspapers have mottos a lot of times. So like the New York Times, their motto is all the news that's fit to print.
Yes.
The new Washington Post motto is, and I am not making this up, democracy dies in darkness, which
sounds, I mean, let's just first say that the intent of the title, Democracy Dies in Darkness, is watch out. Darkness is bad because democracy dies, and it's important to shine a light on the situation.
Right.
And we at the Washington Post will be that light. We
yes.
will hold off the darkness and save democracy.
And you know, the Trump White House just proved their point, of course, by, for no good reason, denying the New York Times, the BBC, and CNN access to the White House press briefing.
And Breitbart, too, right?
Did they deny Breitbart?
You were supposed to say...
Okay. Of course they didn't deny Breitbart. They would never deny... You know, they allow people in like Breitbart and, what is it, Gateway Pundit. Pretty soon it's going to be Alex Jones, who is not the the late deacon from Michigan.
No, it's Catholic, unfortunate that one of them didn't use an initial because people have mixed them up.
Yes. Alex Jones, that I'm referring to, is the barking lunatic who runs a website called InfoWars, which Trump has spoken well of.
That would not be an exaggeration. He literally barks, I'm pretty sure.
He's crazy. That guy is crazy. He is absolutely crazy. But anyway, so the incredibly, the Trump White House just told three very important media outlets that they were not allowed into the press room. Why? Just because of petty vengeance, because he's an autocratic aspiring dictator. And this guy is engaged in a war on the First Amendment. So anyway, WAPO comes out with this motto, democracy dies in darkness. And I think it was Salon had this article saying,
Slate had
this article saying, here are 15 metal albums that are less dark than the Washington Post motto.
And what they've done is they've taken the Washington Post logo and put the titles of the metal albums in italics underneath in looking like the motto. So, for instance, drawing on a 1998 album from a band called Gore Guts, we have the Washington Post. The erosion of sanity. or from a 1989 band by from a 1999 album by a band called Morbid Angel, the Washington Post, Altars of Madness.
Yes, and that's what you want in a free press, you know. So that was pretty fun.
I could actually picture, like, you know, a Motley Crue or Twisted Sister album called Democracy Dies in Darkness.
So that was fantastic. And there's other stuff going on out there. You were mentioning over the break, apparently there's a discussion going on currently about the passage in the gospel where Jesus talks about it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. What's the latest scuttlebutt on the biblical scholarship, sir?
It's not a new proposal. But it was new to me, and it's been circulating because it was just blogged on Patheos by somebody on the Progressive Christian Channel, Benjamin L. Corey, previously unknown to me. And he highlights a translational possibility that I have not heard of before. And first of all, we have to get something off the table, which is this pious idea that circulates in some churches, much beloved of some pastors, that when Jesus talks about a camel going through the eye of a needle, that this is a reference to something called the needle's eye gate of the city of Jerusalem. There's this supposed to be this narrow gate, and I'm told that if you go to Jerusalem now, they'll show you this supposed gate, the needle's eye gate that a camel can actually go through. But here's the sort of homiletic tie-in: only if it's divested of all of its burdens. So if the camel is all loaded up with riches and wealth, it can't go through the eye of a needle. And similarly, the rich man must divest himself. No, that's totally not what Jesus is saying.
Right.
There's absolutely no evidence that this gate was – that there was a gate known as the needle's eye gate at the time of Jesus. Jesus is talking about the literal eye of a sewing needle. So that's – but there is a serious question on whether he was talking about a camel. Now, there is another hyperbole of Jesus where he throws in a camel. You strain at gnats, but you swallow a camel.
Right.
And it's possible that he just – that the camel was just his go-to funny animal. That is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another possibility, and perhaps the use of camel in the one hyperbole suggested the use of camel in another, but in fact an almost identical word. And here's the quirk. The word is almost identical in biblical Greek. It's pronounced identically in modern day Greek, but it's also very, very similar in Semitic languages.
Okay.
Jesus might have used another word that makes a lot more sense in context.
Okay.
There's a word that's pronounced almost identical to camel. It's like camelon in both. And what it means is a rope, like an anchor rope. Like the kind of thick cord or rope that fishermen would use to anchor their boats. This is an image that would make a lot of sense to Jesus' first hearers. You know, imagine trying to take this big, thick rope and put it through the eye of a needle. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more logical and rational than the camel image.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything – I mean, they both convey the idea of impossibility, but the idea of trying to put a rope through the eye of a needle works in the same way as the idea of having a log in your eye. You know, it's taking the thing that you would normally find there and just amplifying it rather than reaching for something totally different. And then camel and the gnat, you know, here again, we're in the same world. We're in the world of animals, but there's one tiny animal that you would actually have in your soup that you strain out. And then there's the much larger animal that would never be there.
I think what I'm taking away from this conversation is that Deacon Stephen Gradonis put together the words, the camel might have been Jesus's go-to funny animal.
That's kind of striking to me as I put those words together.
I'm going to think about that for a long, long time. And I don't really know what conclusions I'll draw from it, but I think it's an important thing for us all to reflect on.
If you ever actually looked at a camel in the face, you might just think that the camel was God's go-to funny animal.
They are just funny looking animals. I mean, and what's with that hump? I mean, come on. That's just weird. But anyway, well, I want to thank you so much, Dick and Steve, for being on the show today. You have been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our co-host today was Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Our producer was Danny Head. And we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a terrific weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.